From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The Arizona Town Hall meeting was held this week in Prescott, Arizona. The main topic of discussion was health care. We'll have a report. The summer season is fast approaching, and that means danger for many migrants trying to cross illegally into the United States. We'll have a feature story on two controversial groups who are working to provide humanitarian aid to migrants on both sides of the border. Plus, an interview with the director of a feature documentary called Squeegee Bandit, making its Arizona premiere this weekend at the Arizona International Film Festival. Those stories and more coming up, but first. Over the course of 3 days this week, more than 100 Arizona residents from all walks of life and all corners of the state gathered at the Arizona Town Hall meeting in Prescott to talk about health care. KUAZ's Christopher Conover was there and says the future of health care is being charted from the grassroots.
For more than four decades, the Arizona Town Hall has brought people together to talk about the issues of the day. Shirley Agnos, the president emerita of the town hall, says the twice-yearly meetings are modeled after the traditional New England town hall.
In this day and age, we just all too seldom put people together where they can face one another and talk back and forth and talk through ideas to see what they have in common, because if you get us all together, you learn that in this country and in this state, we have a lot more in common in what we want for the good of the community than we have disagreement.
The topic of this town hall meeting was health care, how to make it accessible and affordable. Dr. Len Kirshner, the president of the AARP in Arizona, was one of the town hall participants. He says health care access for everyone is a topic that must be addressed.
We have 1 million uninsured in the state. We have 250,000 kids that are uninsured. We need to find a way to say that everyone in our community should have access to some level of basic health care services that, if need be, we subsidize. We made a decision in 1965 that everyone over 65 would have some level of health care coverage. It's called Medicare. I'm over 65 now, and I'm covered by that program. It's pretty simple eligibility. The reality is we haven't done the same thing for our children and for our working adults. And somewhere along the way, we have to make a similar decision to what we did in July of 1965.
But town hall participants were not only addressing the issue of health care access for senior citizens. Sue Myers is the superintendent of the Payson Unified School District and says her constituency cannot be forgotten.
Our future is our children, and healthy children are imperative to that. So many of our kids do not get good care anymore. That's assuming that they did at one time.
And she says health care in the schools is a particular concern for her in Payson.
50% of our population is not insured, so many of our children are not covered with insurance. Kid care reaches some of them, but not as many as it could. I'd like to see our schools have health care right on site for all of our students to take advantage of right then and there.
In addition to pointing out problems with the health care system, some of the participants were on hand to learn how they could improve their services, like Bill Pike with Carondelet.
For me, it's certainly a learning experience because you're here with all types of people with different types of experiences. And it isn't just health providers and health experts, but it's consumers and business representatives. And it's very important for us as health providers to listen to community, because what we do needs to be a reflection of community needs.
And the AARP's Len Kirshner points out that health care is not an issue just limited to Arizona.
The reality is these are issues that are germane to where America is going in the future. So I feel it was really important for me to be here representing the 830,000 AARP members in Arizona.
No members of the legislature were at the meeting. Organizers say that's because in years past, when they were invited, they didn't come due to their ongoing work in the legislative session. So it will be up to participants to lobby state lawmakers for change and to do what they can on a grassroots level to put into action what they learned at the town hall. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Dr. Samuel Keim, an ER physician in Tucson, has devised a scientific index to predict the likelihood that illegal immigrants will die while walking through the Arizona desert during extreme heat conditions. He found that the probability of death reaches 50% when temperatures climb to 104 degrees or higher, a temperature we will likely see in just a few weeks. But there are two local groups trying to prevent migrant deaths in the desert. Samaritan Patrol and No More Deaths are controversial. Some feel they are only encouraging illegal immigration by providing food, water, and medical aid to migrants in the desert, but they feel they're just doing the moral thing. Last summer, I rode along with a few members of Samaritan Patrol as they looked for migrants in distress, and I also spent some time with No More Deaths, who are working on the other side of the border. It's 6 o'clock on a warm July morning, and three women are loading a white SUV at Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson. They pack a cooler of bottled water and boxes of food, clothing, and medical supplies. It's for the day's journey into the desert. Lois, Jody, and Tam are volunteers with Samaritan Patrol, a local group who makes daily trips into the desert, providing aid to migrants who may be in distress. Today, they're patrolling along Highway 86 between milepost 121 and 131 near the Tohono O'odham Reservation. Lois Martin is driving. She pulls off to the side of the road and walks to the edge of a fence. She's not allowed to cross onto the reservation, so she stands next to it and yells,
"Hola! Somos amigos de la iglesia! Tenemos agua! Tenemos comida! Tenemos ayuda médico!"
She offers food, water, and medical aid to anyone who may be in distress. She waits for a reply. Nothing. She tries again.
Tenemos agua. Tenemos comida.
Nothing. So she walks further down the frontage road, observing the trash left by migrants during their journey. Water jugs, clothing, food wrappers, even electrolyte bottles.
When I see that, at least I'm glad because people knew to bring something like that, not just water, but that they knew that was important.
Lois started with Samaritan Patrol this year. This is her eighth patrol in the desert, and as of late, she's noticed fewer and fewer migrants walking this far from the border. The last three times she's gone out, she hasn't seen any.
I think it's clear to me that there are fewer migrants coming through now, and it may well be because the Border Patrol is picking up so many more near the border. And in some ways, I suppose that's good, because at least then people aren't out in the desert so long before they get picked up. On the other hand, so many that they pick up and return to Mexico, they just turn around and they come back already in somewhat compromised health because they've been through this.
Now, if they ask you to call Border Patrol, do you?
Yes, they ask you to call Border Patrol. They'll say that they want us to call 911 or call the Migra, and that they're ready to go back. And of course, if they are ready to go voluntarily, then they will just be taken to the border. They won't be detained.
And I mean, how do you make that phone call? You just call and they know who Samaritan Border Patrol knows who Samaritan Patrol is, and they say we'll be right
out. Sure. Either that, or very often, because we often will see them along here on the highway. Very often, all we have to do is just step out on the highway and flag down a Border Patrol, because the Border Patrol comes by so often. Or sometimes we'll just be calling and a Border Patrol comes along already. And if they see that we're there and see we're stopped, they stop anyway because they know that we're probably talking to migrants. Mm-hmm. Or, you know.
The group heads back to the SUV and patrols further down Highway 86. Their calls go unanswered, so they drive to another area near Three Points. They stop along a bumpy dirt road. Jody Ipsen gets out of the van and surveys the area. She's an English teacher at a local high school in Tucson. She walks into a wash area and yells,
"Tenemos agua, comida, ayuda médico."
No response, so she heads closer in and comes upon a migrant camp, one of many in this area. Everywhere you look, there are empty cans of beans, jalapenos, discarded clothing, and backpacks. Tree branches are bent down to cover a Palo Verde tree. It's here where migrants take cover and rest, but they don't know if the camp has been used recently.
What you want to look for is fresh clothing, fresh backpacks, stuff that isn't sun bleached. They'll carry garlic with them, underwear.
Why garlic?
They put garlic around themselves at night when they sleep or during the day to protect themselves from scorpions and rattlesnakes. They think that the garlic will keep wild animals away. This is a fresh pack of matchbooks. I mean, this matchbook is pretty fresh. You can see it's not faded in any way, really. The matches are still usable, so, you know, people may have been staying here a few days ago. It's hard to say.
The day has come to an end for these volunteers, and they head back to Tucson, feeling like they failed in helping any migrants today, but knowing they tried. They unload the van and head back to their homes. Tomorrow, another group will go out. Meanwhile, across the border, the scene is quite different, with no shortage of migrants. 23-year-old Marieta Vallée is setting up a tent near the Mexican Customs and Immigration Building at the Mariposa Port of Entry. In the distance, a blue tarp is visible on the U.S. side of the border. That's where the National Guard is busy at work. Marieta is the coordinator of the new Nogales program with No More Deaths, a local group that works for the same cause as Samaritan Patrol. She and a group of five other volunteers are setting up to greet buses of migrants who were dropped off at the port by Border Patrol after being apprehended and deported.
We have liter bottles of water, and then we have either sandwiches or little burritos that we have individually wrapped that we give. We also have Gatorade available, and we do blister care and basic medical first aid.
As people come off the buses, they file past the No More Deaths tent and are given food and water. As the first bus arrives, Marieta passes out green flyers with information about the different migrant centers around Nogales that can provide them shelter for the night and help them find work so they can return home. Because by now, many migrants don't have anywhere to turn, no way to get back home.
I think when they're stepping off the bus, they're still in that limbo, that time of still thinking about what their options are, what they're able to do. We know that a lot of people just try to cross again, even though they're in really bad physical condition, because they feel like there's nothing else for them to do. And especially if they've journeyed hundreds of miles and spent thousands of dollars up from someplace like southern Mexico, more than likely they're not going to just try once and then give up. But then, on the other hand, other people feel like they can't continue to try to cross, and so they're just kind of stuck here in northern Mexico.
One of the many services the volunteers provide is blister care. One man limps to the tent, obviously in pain.
Okay, who wants to do blisters for this guy here?
He's 42 years old and was spotted by a Border Patrol helicopter just a little while ago. He had been walking for 3 days and his feet are raw with blisters. Marieta prepares a bucket of water to wash and bandage his feet.
Pretty normal to have lots of blisters in between the toes, and it makes it hard to bandage, but it's very painful. The bottom of every toe and in between the toes.
¿Tiene duele?
So it's rubbed the skin away, so it's very raw.
Once his feet are bandaged, Marieta gives him a pair of socks and laces for his shoes. He tells her he'll return to his home in El Todd to rest and heal, and then he'll try to cross the border again. He's only one of 400 migrants the group will see today, including women and children. Marieta says this is a very crucial point in immigration and border policy. She feels that she can be a voice for these migrants.
Even as a young child, I remember recognizing the disparity of wealth, of livelihood between, you know, just a few hours, between a matter of a few hours of driving from Phoenix down to the beaches where we would go as a family. And I think even as a young child, I began asking why. You know, why is it that I get to sit on the beach with my family and another little girl the same age is selling chicle or other things to the tourists with her mom, not able to go to school necessarily. And so I think I began asking those questions of justice, really, of border and economic justice as a very small child.
Both Samaritan Patrol and No More Deaths are working together to provide humanitarian aid to migrants on both sides of the border. They hope by participating in a bi-national effort, they can help prevent hundreds of deaths in the desert every year. When we continue with Arizona Spotlight, we'll talk with the director of the film called Squeegee Bandit. It's part of the Arizona International Film Festival being held this weekend in Tucson. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The Arizona International Film Festival starts today. It's a venue for independent filmmakers to show their work. This year marks the 16th edition of showcasing independent cinema from around the world. One film in this year's showcase is called Squeegee Bandit, directed by Shandar Lauer in Auckland, New Zealand.
Would you rather me climb through your window at inappropriate times of the night? Or would you rather me come up to you in the broad daylight and ask you for a window wash? You can give me $5 or $500 if you want. It's better than taking a video in a DVD, isn't it?
Squeegee Bandit is a feature documentary film that follows the life and struggles of a man named Starfish, a bigger-than-life street-corner window washer from South Auckland, New Zealand. Among the themes in the film are indigenous land rights, homelessness, displacement in poverty and drug addiction.
My name's Starfish. I'm a Taranaki Māori. I'm Ngā Ruahine. Te toko wāru.
Shandar Lauer is the director of the film. He joins me now in our studios to talk about the film. Shandar, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, the entire film revolves around one man, Starfish. We just heard from him. At times, he seems a little crazy, a little outrageous. How did you find Starfish?
Making a documentary film, I mean, of course, it's based on factual material, but in many ways, it's the same as making any other kind of film. You're looking for strong characters, an interesting story. You want, you know, I wanted to find someone who I knew would change and grow through the course of the film. And I spent about 4 months looking for the right person. It's just, in a way, it's like casting for any kind of film, except that the people I was meeting didn't know they were sort of auditioning to be in my movie. So I spent 4 months going around the streets of Auckland, New Zealand, just meeting window washers on the street corner, introducing myself, saying what I was doing, and having a chat. And then one day I went down to the Otara Markets, which is a big Polynesian market in South Auckland, which is kind of a, you know, rough neighborhood. And I see this guy there, and he's just making hand over fist because there are people who, window washers, who try and make money by intimidating people or trying guilt tripping them into giving money. But this guy sort of understood that washing windows on the street corner is more like street theater than customer service. So he was making a personal connection with each of his, you know, semi-willing customers and making hand over fist. And at the same time, here's a guy, when he's taking his break, he's telling his stories of his many exploits to the other window washers who could be, you know, 10 feet away making a lot of money, and they're just there with their jaws wide open listening to his story. So our eyes met across the crowded parking lot, and I knew this was the guy for me.
What kind of story was he telling?
He tells a lot of stories of grassroots stories of kind of survival on the front lines of the poverty war in New Zealand. The stories of people that are struggling to get by and their experience in life that is really not heard in any kind of public way anywhere else, I don't think.
And Starfish is one of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he talks about his survival skills. It's kind of interesting. Basically, you know, Maori people and indigenous people all over the world, including here in Tucson, have been colonized by Western culture and the kind of capitalist understanding of the world where everything is based around money. And what Starfish has done is adapted to that very well, you know, understood, let's see, this is about markets, this is about survival of the fittest by any means necessary, and he's done that in every way that he can.
Well, throughout the film, there's been various, I guess, run-ins with the police, and he talks about drugs, and when the camera was on him, and he would kind of confess, you know, things that from his past or what he's thinking. Were those things thought about in advance, or was that just really Starfish speaking off the top of his head?
I think one of the greatest things, you know, the greatest gifts any subject can give a documentary maker is just to be honest, just to tell the truth, which is a very rare thing. And I found him. I knew he was such a gem because I found a guy who would speak his truth exactly as he experienced it and felt it. And that is such a rare thing. You know, he's not shamed to tell, to be himself on the camera. I really, when I make films, I really, I think I base most of my work on very ancient stories of classical mythology. You basically, in any kind of mythology, whether in Maori mythology, you know, Native American, European, or any culture in the world, you have this figure of the hero that is superhuman in the sense that this person can do things that no one else can do, these amazing feats. And you clearly see in the film, Starfish can. I mean, he's cheated death many times. Anyone else growing up in a situation like he has would be very lucky to survive. Every great hero has to have these amazing exploits and at the same time have terrible, deep flaws.
Well, let's talk about his past. What happened to him in his past that kind of caused him to be deeply flawed?
Starfish grew up in a family that where he was adopted at a young age. His foster parents were very abusive to him. He had a childhood that was just horrific, and you'll see part of that in the film and part of that things that I know that I just will have to take to my grave that are even worse than what's described in the film. And he's dealt with that, you know, in the best way that he can. But you see that this damage, you know, was done to him as a young child is going to affect him for the rest of his life.
There's a scene in the film where Starfish is talking about how many times he has moved in the past year.
I would have probably moved in 30-odd addresses in the last 12 months. There's nearly two cases a month. Yeah, I'm going for the Guinness Book of Records. I'm sure I have got it, man. I'm sure I've got it. Is there a record for that? I've got it, man. I've got it. Guinness Book of Records, I've moved around about 30-odd places. Yeah!
Is that something that he chooses to do, or is that something he has to do?
I think he was quite accurate in describing having moved around 30 places. It's, you know, he's just always teetering on the verge of homelessness. I mean, it's a great irony that in New Zealand and the United States and many other countries, the indigenous people of that country, the people who were there first, are really, you know, at the bottom rung of society, that the people who are the original landowners are now the people who are most in the prisons and most in mental hospitals and most in non-mental hospitals and the most homeless, the most jobless, the most, you know, problems with drugs and alcohol, that the people who the land really, really belongs to are the most homeless group in the country. So he's going around from place to place, sleeping on people's couches. He was, just before I came on this trip, he was sleeping on my couch for a couple of weeks.
A very interesting part in the film is when Starfish is talking about his relationship with God.
God's still in me. You know, I haven't really erased him completely. We're going to work something out. He's got a plan for me. He's got a plan for all of us. His plan for me is to be one of his warriors, a warrior for him, a soldier, one of his foot soldiers. Go around and gather up all the broken hearts of people and try and mend them.
Those are really profound words, I thought.
I thought the day I was filming, I thought, wow, what a gift. I'm not a Christian myself, though I have read and studied a lot of the Bible. I think Jesus is a great guy. Certainly think the world would be better if many people followed the ideas that he believed in. And I think, you know, I would imagine Jesus coming back and walking down Great South Road in Manurewa, South Auckland. You know, he'd be sort of humming along to the Polynesian music, blasting out of the cars and the stores. And he would say, you know, blessed are the window washers, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and they shall inherit the earth.
How is Starfish taking everything now that the documentary has been released? What does he think about the film?
I didn't show it to him. I made it very clear during the filming that he would see it when it was done. So I showed it to him when it was done. And I did have some concerns about, you know, he does get quite angry at some parts and how would he feel about that. You know, you see in the film that he's a different person by the end than he was in the beginning, and he's even a different person now. There are really two things that have made a big change in his life. One of them, he's in a relationship now that is very stable and is with a woman who I think is really good for him, and I think they're good for each other. Her influence on him has really helped him. You know, he's off the drugs and off the drink now, which has made an amazing positive change in his life. And the another thing is, you know, he's seen this film. I think there are very few people that have the opportunity to see that film, see what how you appear through in the eyes of other people. So he saw that, and he sees, you know, he sees this amazing person that he is, full of hope and inspiration. And at the same time, he sees his anger in a way that he hasn't seen it before. And I think that has really helped him to have a better understanding of it and get more control of his emotions.
Squeegee Bandit makes its Arizona premiere at the Arizona International Film Festival on April 22nd at 6 p.m. at the Screening Room on East Congress Street here in Tucson. For more information about the film, visit squeegeebandit.com. For a list of other films that are part of the film festival, visit filmfestivalarizona.com. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Bierwacher.